Hello and welcome to 12 Rules to What. This is a podcast about fascism, anti-fascism and the far right. My name is Alex and I'm joined as always by Solon.
Hello everyone.
Well, I say as always, but you were actually there for the last episode, so...
I know, I've had a lot on recently, but I'm back.
I don't think we've got any announcements. Just make sure you follow us on social media, at 12 Rules to What, or support us on Patreon if you like our work. This episode, the recording went really long, so I think... we'll have some bonus content upon the on the Patreon for supporters, and we'll maybe release it later, but maybe not. So if you really want to listen to it, really interested in it, then go and check it out for as little as $2 a month. Today we're talking to Adrian Weeks, who's an activist and researcher on anti-fascism in Norway.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to 12 Rules for What. My name is Solon. I'm joined today by my senior podcast co-host Alex, as well as this week's guest, the activist and researcher Adrian, who has written probably the most comprehensive and rigorous study of anti-fascism in Norway, primarily in the 1980s and 1990s. Welcome Adrian, and hello Alex.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks Solan for the introduction. So Adrian, I guess to start off for our audience, can you tell us a bit about the emergence of the neo-Nazi movement in Norway in the years after World War II?
Yes. So I'm going to begin there immediately after World War II, but I'm going to keep that part brief. Norway was one of the countries that were occupied by Germany during the Second World War. And as such, immediately after the World War, there was a reckoning for those who had collaborated or been part of the occupational government. Nazi, classical Nazi organizing in the immediate aftermath was just... creating texts and creating discourse around the unfairness of the trials and so on and so forth. It wasn't until, and that was the case for a long time. It wasn't until the end of the 60s where any kind of forward pointing political plans or goals or visions started to take place. It usually had a anti-communist way of describing their goals with the description of communist being pretty broad. In the 60s, Norway began to have their first real waves of immigration from non-Western countries. And that immediately became a focus point for not just what I would call fascist elements, but the entirety of the conservative right movement, but especially a party named after a person called Anders Langes Parti, where Anders Lange was the party chairman. To a certain extent, though, that will be highly disputed, still exists today. It is the precursor of the Progress Party, which is the more national chauvinistic, but also with a kind of libertarian streak party in Norway. To get to the point in time that is most relevant for my research, we actually have to go quite late. We are in the mid-70s, where, for example, yes, we're in the mid-70s, where a group called Norsk Front, which for you guys in England, is inspired by the English National Front. And we will see this a lot, that in both fascist quarters and in anti-fascist quarters, there was a lot of inspiration taken from tendencies in Great Britain, and especially the UK. So with the formation of the Andersslangesparti and Norsk Front, we kind of have like a two-pronged vision of how to draw the country to the right and create a national chauvinist climate. And one is through the electorate, and the other is through activities on the street level. And in my degree, this is called a two-front strategy. So we have these groups that terrorize, for example, immigrant shops, and then we have this electoral project. And what we see is that there's a lot of overlap in membership, there's a lot of communication, and there's a lot of public distancing. So the electoral parts will publicly distance themselves from the violence, but the membership will go back and forth, and money will go back and forth, and all of that. Like a lot of right wing extremist organizations, unity does not last long. And once we got into the 90s, we have to talk about a lot more groups. But I personally find that kind of uninteresting, because what we see is that the membership overlaps to such an extreme degree that it's usually three or four groups that are the same group, but with different names. At this point in the late 70s, we also get the first terrorist actions in Norway. So Norway is generally a very small and a very peaceful country. Really blow the hair back of your listeners in England, the number of people who have died in strikes is in the single digits. So there's not really a lot of labor violence. There's not really a lot of terrorism. And the first terrorist attack we get is in 1977, where a bomb is thrown at a bookshop in Tromsø. And 2 years later, a bomb is thrown in the 1st of May parade. And this bomb, the second attack, was thrown by one of two persons that will you'll actually get to know the names of in our talks. It's Petter Skyvik. He threw this bomb, luckily not killing anyone, but he got a very short 5-year prison sentence and became kind of a martyr and hero in the neo-fascist, neo-Nazi milieu of the 1990s. I'm going to stop there. And if I need to clarify, please let me know what you're wondering.
Yeah, because just to kind of almost just summarize, but like the key kind of structure then that sort of emerges over the course of those decades after kind of struggling awkwardly to find its feet is this two-pronged approach that you get both an electoral wing and a kind of more violent street wing, which I think is broadly resonant with how neo-fascist and neo-Nazi movements in the rest of Europe kind of
Oh, yes, absolutely. Work. I think this is a tried and true, especially in the 90s, tactic all over Europe. I think it's just much more apparent in Norway, where the entire milieu is so small.
Right.
So conversely, maybe if you could just introduce the anti-fascist movement, because obviously we always try to talk about fascism and anti-fascism in connection with each other because they intrinsically are. How did the anti-fascist movement come to bite? What are the kind of fundamental building blocks of anti-fascism in Norway?
Right. So here we are. Here we are in danger of tumbling into some like fraught territory when it comes to the autonomous left versus the more electoral or statist left organizations. Obviously, here I have to show my bias as well. I am an anarchist, and I was part of the autonomous movement, and it's the centerpiece of my research. However, there is, like all other countries, the left more broadly, or socialist or communist organizations more broadly, have always been anti-fascist, and have always tried to disrupt or otherwise. And they have always tried to disrupt or otherwise hinder fascist organizing. What is the center of my research is, and also what I think is the by far the most important anti-fascist activity, sprung up around the autonomous left movement. So it is centered in the 90s around the subcultural youth movement. And in Norway, that means, or in Norway and Oslo, that means around the occupied house called Blitz. However, before this, communist parties have try to stop rallies and have stopped meetings. However, they were very dismissive of the efforts by Blitz and other groups in the beginning of the 1990s.
So your research is on the anti-fascist struggle in the 80s and 90s. What happened in those decades and why was it so violent? And Selden has put a little comment in the questions for me to ask you, what the fuck was up with Johnny Olsen? I have no idea who this guy is, but maybe you can elaborate.
Right. So, yes. So, again, it was very, very violent. And I will talk about Johnny Olsen in this at this juncture, because he's the other one of the two. We have Petter Skivik, this bomb-throwing guy who threw this bomb in 1979, went to prison for a short while, 5 years, and returned. And we have Johnny Olsen. And he was also first, we first learn about him when we should stop learning about him, because the first thing we hear about this man is that he was sent away to prison for murder. And it's actually a wild story. So there was an organization called Norges Germanske Armé. The Norwegian, like German, as in like large, Norway's Germanic army was founded in 1980s, and its first point of order was to order weapon theft. They wanted to arm themselves. However, complications arrived. We don't know the nature of the complications, but during the handover, the Nazis, including Johnny Olsen, murdered the three thieves that they had commissioned for this weapon theft. And all of them, all the three Nazis that killed the three thieves, were sentenced and put in prison. Among them was Johnny Olsen. He would spend 10 years in prison, or a little less, and then come out and start a new organization called Anti-Antifa. So, if you're familiar with math, you can just yes, we can surmise this is a fascist organization. They started making bomb threats, especially towards some really strange targets. They tr threatened to bomb these in Norway we have children's parades and on the national holiday, so that's the 17th of May. And instead of like tanks and soldiers and stuff, you have children waving flags and eating ice cream and walking in a parade. And they threatened to bomb one of these parades at a school which had people from many different backgrounds. So one of the most varied and diverse schools in Oslo got this bomb threat. They also threatened to bomb the ceremony around Desmond Tutu's acceptance of the Peace Prize. And during the 90s, Johnny Olsen is at the center of a staggering number of violent altercations. And very often involving firearms, which raises all kinds of questions and really kind of shows in a Norwegian context how central very few people are for the direction things take. So we have this neo-fascist organization that is centered around people who are connected with terror and murder, and they really inform just how extreme the street level part of this two-pronged strategy becomes, because they are the heroes, they're the eldest, they have a lot of experience, both in and out of prison, and they're looked up to. On the flip side of this, it also becomes very hard for them to do anything that could resemble like a mass mobilization. So that is very much left up to the electoral kind of anti-immigration part of the conservative right. Because you have to be, for the most part, male, able-bodied, and willing to fight and risk jail time and bodily injury to take part in this street level. It also means that the people who get in the way the anti-fascists are risking a lot.
Yeah, because I suppose one thing that really struck me reading your work was the amount of not just brawls and fistfights, but bombings and shootings that, well, overwhelm. I mean, the shootings, I think, exclusively neo-Nazi, or neo-Nazi was on the Nazi side, but like there was a pretty remarkable level of violence, really. Which, as you pointed out initially, like that Norway, with the exception of, you know, during the war years, social conflict has tended not to assume like a violent character, even when compared to like neighboring countries, like in Sweden or in the rest of Europe, it's tended not to be so shooty. And it seems really striking that these decades were so violent at the grassroots level. I don't want to sidetrack us too much into like conspiracy stuff here, but reading up on Jonny Olsen and the like, is there evidence of kind of state collusion in keeping this guy on the street? Because he kept shooting guns at people and then being released many times.
There is not evidence of like state collusion. What there is a lot of evidence of is the state really, really, and I will get into this when we get to like the counter extremism and talk about other ways of looking at the fascist threat. But one of the times Jonny Olsen, he opened up a gun, he fired in a crowded bar twice, and then chased the anti-fascists out on the street and fired his gun in a crowded street twice, and told the police that he acted in self-defense, and that was enough for him to not be tried for this. So, and the reason is that I think at this point, they looked at anti-fascists and fascists as two sides of the same coin, equally violent, equally extreme. That allowed them to look at this extremely dangerous man in this extremely dangerous situation and actually think that that argument had any merit. So that's not just in Norway. I think generally there's a culture in law enforcement and in government to view fascism and anti-fascism much like you would, kind of like a Blood and Crips like gang situation, and not.
Yes, because I think in your work there is a quote from the police at the time who described that particular incident of the shooting in the bar as a, they think they call it like a political gang fight or a politicized gang fight or something like that, quite explicitly.
Yes, they used the Norwegian word bande oppgjør, and bande is a gang. So yeah, so like so they kind of like it, they called it a gang. But that still doesn't explain why you don't get jailed for unloading a firearm in a crowded bar and then in a crowded street. Like it's a miracle that people didn't die. On a personal note, I like, as someone who kind of grew up after this, I was born in 1986 and I lived in Oslo since 2005. Like, I kind of grew up in a like safe post-Nazi Oslo, and going back to this, I had the same, when I was writing this, I had the same the same reaction as when you were reading it, like how the violence was so extreme and so one-sided. Like the how this idea was able to survive in Norway, that these two groups kind of like were just doing their own thing to each other. And like the violence, because the violence didn't only affect anti-fascists. All manner of immigrants were targeted by these people. All manner of marginalized groups were targeted by these people. And it really pissed me off when I was writing this, what extreme blinders people can have. And like my sources are not niche. Like this, all of this, like it was real, really violent. So all of this is reported in just like the daily news, but it's not analyzed for what it should be.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I also, for a bit of podcast lore, I also grew up in Oslo and around the same years as you're describing. And I also remember kind of becoming politically active, you know, after the period that you're describing, and then kind of hearing from older people what things used to be like, you know, and these kinds of stories and anecdotes and incidents that people would be recounting. And then reading your research, I was just like, oh, wow, they really weren't, they weren't exaggerating. Like, it was pretty wild. But I want to kind of shuffle us along, because the focus of your work really is the anti-fascist movement, right? And so, and in a sense, as kind of both of our experiences attest to, the anti-fascist movement, despite all this shooting and bombing, the anti-fascist movement in Oslo was actually wildly successful in some ways.
Yes, I would say absolutely so. And it's a really interesting story as well. A lot of people, once they're finished with their degrees, they get sick of the subject matter. I really don't. So the story of anti-fascism in Norway, and I'm saying Norway, I'm really focusing on Oslo and the surrounding areas or surrounding towns and cities. But the story of this is one that starts in isolation and ends in a political acceptance of confrontational strategies. So at the beginning, there were parts of the socialist/communist party that today is known as Rødt, but at that point was known as Røde Valgallianse, as well as Blitz, and at the very beginning of the 90s, AFA was founded. So that obviously stands for Anti-Fascist Action, not the only country to have an AFA, or also today known as an Antifa, if we're going to bring American nomenclature into this. It was founded in, I'm not sure, I actually can't remember the exact year now, but it was in the early 90s. I think it was 1990, actually. And these groups started just trying to mess up anti-immigrant rallies and meetings, like congresses and conventions. And as the fascist threat escalated, they also had to escalate. So it began as kind of these fascist elements or these anti-immigrant parties the electoral or the street centered organizations would try and have some kind of event, and then they would go and try and sabotage it. And a lot of, at this point, most of the organized left, most of the parties felt this was time wasted. That this was not necessary, that it was stupid, that it brought more attention to them, that everybody should just remain home and ignore them. And that they were very, very isolated. However, they first started to make headway against the anti-immigrant parties, because obviously you can get political parties to kind of protest another political party, especially if it's quite vulgar in its racism. The electoral part of this two-pronged strategy had tried to have their rallies. They had failed, and that kind of meant that it was up to the street gangs, the fascist street gangs. At this point, there's so many organizations. I'm going to mention two. I promise you there are more, and I promise you they don't matter. The big ones are Anti-Antifa, which is purely a terror organization. So this is where you go if you are a little bit older, you like guns, bombs, and you want to commit terror. And here Jonny Olsen is the most important person. And you have Viking, which is the youth. Kind of, they recruit at schools. You shave your head. You become part of this this skinhead kind of fascist gang. But we are talking about anti-fascist. I just want to give you a little bit of context as to like what kind of people they're organizing against at this point, because it's no longer these electoral anti-immigrant parties. What begins happening is the fascists find that they need a place. They want a place as a base of operations in Oslo. And I would say throughout the first half of the 90s, the anti-fascist strategy is denying them such a place. So it begins with the fascists try to find bars that will serve them, and they do. And they get drunk, do some drugs, and they go out and hunt people. And so the anti-fascist strategy has to be short-term and long-term. Short-term, it means patrolling and protecting their community. And at some point, and this is the most intense part of like anti-fascist violence, and by that I mean anti-fascists looking to commit violence, planning it, and assaulting people, they would just invade these bars and beat up all the Nazis there, yell at the owners not to serve them. They would find them when they were hunting in the streets and hunt them back. And long-term strategy, they had demonstrations against the bars that serve them. And these could attract more people than just a hardcore core of Blitz-Afa, but was a general, more a general leftist kind of thing to do. So long term, you could have some alliances, but short term, you were just these more parts of the autonomous left here. As I said, this was the period with the most like anti-fascist initiated violence, and it was successful. After 1994, they had no places would serve them. And they shifted to try and create their own kind of, not occupied, but kind of rent a space of their own, have it as a headquarters. And again, as a historian, it would be nice to neatly say that, from 90 to 94, they did bars. And from 94 and outwards, they did trying to get places. Obviously, real history doesn't work like that. So the first attempt was in 1992, while they were still doing their bar stuff as well. That did not work. They had a demonstration against this place. And during the demonstration, one of the anti-fascists had their eye put out by a sling. And that gave the police the opportunity to raid the place, where they found a lot of firearms. And they were also able to... the arrest record really shows how tight-knit the electoral and the street portions of these different organizations were, because they were all there together. And when they looked at the lease, it was one of these, they were both the street level fascists on the lease and people from these parties on the lease. And the work that anti-fascists had done in participating in meetings, going to places, and trying to kind of bring the left together really started to pay off. So, for example, there was a planned concert. They didn't know where it was, but they were able to have a massive demonstration with everyone from the Labour Party to unions. Holocaust survivors showed up to speak. It was a huge, huge deal. And AFA found a location. And when they found a location, 300 people took the train there. 400 people took the train there. And were not able to stop the concert, but the concert, several of the bands didn't dare show up. And was able to have the biggest anti-fascist demonstration in this like small town outside of Oslo that the city had seen. And from there on, we kind of go to a kind of a victory lap kind of period. And it's important to note, because like my thesis is for from the late 80s to 2001. From 1996, people had this under control. There were no like regular bar hangs. There were no places. Every attempt at a concert was either underwhelming or failed. But at the same time, the areas outside of Oslo saw an increase, a spike. So neo-Nazis were no longer able to organize in the capital. And that has all kinds of effects, right? It has a demoralizing effect. It has several political effects. It has all kinds of effects that Oslo was kind of off limits after 1996. It also had a an effect where the only people who were still neo-Nazis were the most violent. So this period ends sadly with a murder. A young teenager named Benjamin Hermansen was stabbed to death by three neo-Nazis in 2001. And at this point, recruitment was so low and opposition became so much that it effectively killed the huge mass mobilizations that happened after this murder. Effectively killed the neo-Nazi presence.
There's a lot more I want to ask about here, but I think I want to kind of, maybe we can come back to kind of more of like lessons to be learned from this time period and from these mobilizations later on. But I wanted to kind of zoom us out a little bit and kind of both address to yourself and to Alex as well, because as a researcher, you've done the first sort of scholarly, academically rigorous study of this period of anti-fascism, at least focusing on anti-fascist mobilization. And I wanted to ask a bit about that, like kind of what does the scholarship on the period kind of look like, and why did you feel the need to get involved, basically? Why did you decide to produce a scholarly piece of work like this?
Well, first of all, obviously, if you are hoping to be the first in anything, inevitably won't be. And there was one other master's thesis that arrived 6 months before mine that also... It is different from mine. It's very, very different from mine. But it had it focused on purely the ideological part of the anti-fascist movement in the 90s. So it also looks at publications and analyzes them. And those parts are similar to mine. Thankfully, I'm glad we didn't come to very different conclusions when it comes to reading the same material. Just to show that I'm not the only one, but I am one of two that has written about this.
It's the case that, you know, a lot of, like, when you're talking about anti-fascist street movements or like the more militant side of anti-fascism, like a lot of this stuff is kind of understudied or under-researched, and a lot of like very kind of important histories end up getting lost just because people age out of the movement and are not around or can't be found, or, you know, people get older, or, you know, a lot of the stuff people do in the past, or a lot of stuff people do in the course of their activism, they probably don't want to tell to some, you know, kind of researcher from some university somewhere. Do you know what I mean? It's an important area to be like working in, but also there are like quite a lot of difficulties there as well, I think.
Yes. So there's a lot, there's a huge, like there's a will problem and there's a way problem. So the will problem is quite simple. Like the people this is interesting for are activists for the most part. Not it doesn't really help to for someone in government to learn that actually social movements are what is driving these successes. No, it's not really that's not the answer they're looking for, and so they don't ask the questions that will produce that answer. But also, as you said, like finding sources for this is very difficult. And like the only reason people are willing to speak to me, I obviously didn't only speak to people. I also read produced material and but even that, I was able to collect material And I was able to speak to people because people knew me in the movements. For scholars who are interested in this, even if they're genuinely interested, there's a lot of security culture around this. And there's in Norway an extreme antipathy to especially sociologists and anthropologists looking into this. And the reason I find, and I think my critiques of the counter-extremism researchers in Norway are quite harsh in my thesis. I also think that a lot of the criticisms that are leveled to them by anti-fascists are wrong, and when they made them in the 90s. But the reason they are made is because some of them are right. And the parts that are right is anthropologists would lie about them in their research by simply not, like, they didn't, okay, I have to be really clear here. So let's zoom out. The way the counter-extremism researchers in Norway operated was they would try and sit in and, like, not be a part of, but, like, be with neo-fascists and anti-fascists. However, the anti-fascists would say no. Because the researchers that wanted to show up, they weren't trusted. And then they would obviously just sit with one part of this whole equation, and then they would publish research papers and go out in media and say, these two groups have this dynamic. And they would say this having researched one of the two groups. And that is, in my view, incredibly disingenuous. And it creates kind of, it has created in Norway, like, a culture where, as a researcher, like, if you want to research people within these within, like, these tendencies, you better have been part of these tendencies yourself. There is really no other way to gain access, and so of course that limits research, right?
It should be said for our listeners that Adrian is a bit of a legend in Oslo, so that clearly does help gain access to these scenes. But yeah, I think on that note also, and I think this is, again, kind of a question a bit directed to the both of you, but I'm kind of wondering about this. Obviously, you're doing this research from a political perspective, right? That you've kind of situated yourself politically. Where, and also what you're saying is that the kinds of conclusions that emerge from your work about the importance of social movements and direct action, this is quite different than the kind of, I suppose, policy-led anti-extremism research, right, that these people were going for. And I'm wondering over the course, and you're also treading a little bit of a difficult balance here, because on the one hand, you're mobilizing your own kind of, I suppose, credibility and reputation in the movement, even as you're kind of proximate to the heirs of these researchers from the 90s who are anti-extremism researchers that are themselves kind of maybe proximate to law enforcement or to the state in different ways. How did you find navigating that on a kind of practical level? I think it's something that a lot of researchers on fascism and anti-fascism kind of encounter.
It was quite difficult. I had to be very, very cognizant of this. I was also in a situation where I was desperate to do a good job and be taken seriously. So I was very rigorous with myself, and one of the things that I did was, if you look for what you want to find, you'll find it. So I purposely looked for things I didn't want to find. I tried to look for things among the counter-extremism researchers that I thought made sense and was succinct and insightful. And I ended up finding a lot. I think the general climate in research, why this research was so important to do, from my understanding, was it hadn't been done. It hadn't been done because there was no trust for in anti-fascist circles for researchers. And the reason why there wasn't any trust for researchers was that they had lied about these anti-fascist groups. And the way they had done this was they had tried to get embedded in these groups to sit in and meetings and events, both in neo-Nazi and in anti-fascist circles. The anti-fascists had said no, and the neo-Nazis had said yes. And so they did that, but then they put out academic texts and went out in the papers and made claims like these two groups have this dynamic, having only researched one of the two. And that really warps their perspective. But when I looked through all of their statements and read their books, I found that they had there was a bunch of similarities between how they and their analysis of neo-fascism. And for example, I have a quote here where the most hated of these counter-extremism researchers in my sources, whose name is Tore Bjørgo, and who today still leads the counter-extremism institute here in Norway, said that national chauvinism and xenophobia have become acceptable in Norwegian politics. And by articulating these kinds of bad, these kind of xenophobic attitudes, they have opened a gateway for more extreme both actions and policy suggestions. And he even goes to say that a lot of the violence toward minority or marginalized groups is bound to organized milieus on the extreme right in politics. Now, this is an analysis that I think all anti-fascists would concur with. So the problem isn't necessarily with the analysis of like exactly what's happening, but there's a lot of other analysis that are really, really problematic. And I think that you will find other places as well, without me being an expert on other places. I will say that I, looking at the debates from other countries, I find this tendency everywhere. And it has several, there are several reasons for it, right? So the first is Tore Bjørgaas and other counter-extremism researchers in Norway, their job was to create policy for the government. Meaning they had to give the government something actionable, right? And telling the government, can you please be less racist? That's not actionable for them. So what is actionable? Well, what's actionable is police, right? If this is a gang situation, if this is youth crime, which is how they phrased it, then all kinds of policies can be created around those. And some of them are even effective to some extent, right? So in one place in Norway, not all over, a thing that would happen is if your teenage son, and I'm assuming a male here, was taken doing something illegal as part of this neo-Nazi group, they would just haul him to the station and call his mom. And that was actually effective. But it's obviously only effective if you see this as a youth gang problem. That will not be effective with Jonny Olsen. That will not be effective with Petter Sjøvik.
Did they ever try to call Jonny Olsen's
mom? Yeah, who knows? Who knows, right? Maybe. But
maybe she was more scary than he was.
If they did contact Jonny Olsen's mother, it was not effective.
No.
Okay. So that we have these ways into this that are like not correct. Like this isn't a youth gang violence problem. This is a racism problem. But the only actionable pieces of advice they could give was like, this is how you can use police. This is how you can use social workers. This is how you can use the government. So that's like one major issue that is why I think all of their research today or their old research today is unusable. Because today in Scandinavia, the neo-fascist groups are all above, all their members are above 30. But they still function exactly the same. They have a two-pronged approach. There's street people and there's electoral people. They do everything they did in the 90s, but most of the people aren't underage. Right? But So the general anti-fascist analysis still works because it didn't center youth. But the Norwegian counter-extremism approach does not work because it said, oh, this is youth that are bored and have nothing to do, or youth that struggle at home, or youth that are alienated. And like those can be like correct individual reasons, but they're not the correct, like, societal structural reasons.
You also see, like, with this kind of counter-extremism framing, it's there's a kind of, the transgression is not, like you said, the transgression is not racism or the fact that these groups are racist and fascist. The transgression is stepping beyond the bounds of acceptable political activity as defined by the state, right?
Yes, we want to end violence, not end racism.
And you see this, like, for example, if we look at the UK, with the government, it's brought out a new definition of extremism, and there already existed that questioning, like, what they called fundamental British values, which is like parliamentary democracy, rule of law, all this kind of different kind of stuff. Questioning that makes you an extremist, and so Michael Gove, the community secretary, who's a horribly Islamophobic man, and was caught a couple of years ago when he was doing a TV interview with books from Arctos Media, which is a fascist publishing house, on his bookshelf in his study. but he kind of named he named some far right groups that he was saying would fall under this new definition of extremism. But he also named what he termed Islamist groups, including an NGO called CAGE, which has done a lot of good work around counter-terror legislation and things like that. And, you know, someone said to me that it's really just opening up a door. Once the state has got this power to declare groups extremist, it can be applied more broadly and towards the left as well. And, you know, we're also seeing that in the UK with the Prevent strategy, which is a strategy to a counter-extremism, state-sponsored counter-extremism program, now is been expanded again to include being a communist or being a socialist or being an anti-fascist within the purview of that program. And that's Prevent is specifically targeted towards, you know, youth, but, it's also applied more broadly as well.
Exactly. So, like, there's all kinds of different, because that is the other main problem, right? So a lot of these counter-extremism research groups, yeah, they are only, well, they're focused on extreme acts and not the social movement basis that allows these groups to function, and the discursive room that is open for them in society at large. And because these things require a structural analysis, and my third most important critique of the counter-extremism is that it centers the individual extremism, extremist, in a way that's very clear in Norway, where like almost everything is about, does this action help or hinder a hypothetical or real neo-Nazi in getting out of the neo-Nazi groups? And like that can be a valid thing to want, right? These kind of exit kind of strategies that, like, we help these far-right extremists kind of get out of a bad scene. That's fine. I would say that's fine, and also that's not anti-fascism. That's something else. Anti-fascism isn't about the fascist. Anti-fascism is about the rest of the community. Because it completely changes what's right and what works and doesn't. Because those are two. Let me try and break this down. In the sources, it's very clear that the anti-fascist's goal is to hinder and prevent fascist organizing, meaning more than one person, right? However, looking at this from their sociological lens, the counter-extremists in Norway's goal was, why do people become extremists? What can we do to help them? And that's an individual question. So they use statistics, but the statistics are like, how many of these people have divorced parents? And it's like, okay, cool. So they struggle at home, therefore they hate the Jews. There's like there were like 900 Jews in Norway at this point. None of them have ever met a Jew. Like there's no correlation here. And the focus on we have to help these people not be Nazis, that changes what works and doesn't, right? So an argument they would typically make is, if you beat this Nazi up, he has no recourse but to go back to his other Nazis, right? We need to be more inclusive and kind of like coax them out of Nazism. However, And that can be true. Like in an individual case, that can be true. However, on an organizational level, the anti-fascists argued, oh no, when they are drinking in their bars, we have to storm the bars in order to protect our community. And to show them that this will not be tolerated here, and this is very crucial, to demoralize and isolate. Because now the only people who will show up to the next bar gathering are people who are willing to fight. And that means you have a more isolated and weaker movement. And that is a much more group-centered approach, a much more structurally centered approach. And it's an approach, weirdly, considering I'm talking about the most violent anti-fascist activity in Norway, it is an approach kind of centered in activist empathy. Like, I think all radical left-wing activists know what demoralization and burnout looks like. And the goal, and this is, does sound kind of cruel, is to inflict that on fascists. That your events will fail, you'll blame each other, you'll resent each other. Only the people who are the least charismatic and clever will want to participate, because to participate, you have to be willing to engage in violence at a moment's notice. These things weaken the movement. They may not weaken the individual fascist, right? One fascist might become more violent. That is true. But also, one fascist might be, this shit isn't worth it. I have other priorities in my life as well. So for me, when I first began this, I wanted to kind of do something impossible, which was answer the question, does confrontational tactics work? Yes or no? Does violence work? Yes or no? And that question to me is impossible to answer in an empirical way. But what I will say is, confrontational tactics do limit the organizational capacity of neo-fascist movements.
Well, this kind of ties in a bit with, I guess, my kind of final question here, which is, as you outlined in the text, and as you've outlined there as well, that this strategy of demoralization, you know, so that by the mid to late 90s, the Nazis, they can't go to the pub, they can't organize a gig, they can't hang out in town, they can't have a social center. And the anti-fascist publications at the time then kind of described this as a, as you've also done there, like a vicious cycle, so that only the most committed, but also, you know, most, I suppose, like violent and unstable and eccentric people remain in the Nazi movement. And that indeed, the anti-fascists at that time were predicting that this would lead to greater isolation, potentially then to an act of violence or terrorism so ugly that it would end the movement, which was then borne out by the murder of Benjamin Hermansen and the national kind of disgust at that murder and mourning.
And that has all kinds of moral implications, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause this is, I guess, my question. When I read that quote, which you said was a bit of a consensus at that time, during the victory lap, so to speak. I mean, I couldn't help but think about, you know, what happened in 2011 when certainly the most lethal terrorist attack in Norwegian history happened, when indeed a neo-Nazi massacred scores of people, young people. And that also, you know, so that this, and he again was at least understood in the press, you know, to be a so-called lone wolf murderer. And at least initially, it was the initial psychiatric evaluation also emphasized like his pathological state over his political commitments. And I'm kind of wondering, these anti-fascist tactics, they were very successful in defeating half of this two-pronged approach, but, and certainly in Norway today, there's much less of a Nazi street presence than there was in the 1990s.
Oh, absolutely.
But the electoral approach has been very successful. The kind of cultural hegemony has been, you know, really swung to the right in a major way since the 1990s.
Oh, absolutely. I think I get where you're going with
right.
this. But that's kind of a main criticism of the left more generally. Because you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Like this, like I mentioned this as being successful, but it's very important to make the distinction you're making here, that it was successful in one half of the strategy. And it was unsuccessful, but again, it wasn't trying to stop. They didn't go to these political parties' houses and beat them up, right? So they left the electoral part of this to the left parties, right? Like we're street people, we'll deal with the other street people on the other side here, and the political parties, they'll have to be the ones to come up with the political solutions and visions to defeat the conservative anti-immigrant right-wing parties. So I would say like anti-fascism is not necessarily the like anti-fascist strategies are not sufficient to defeat racism. Now, I mean to defeat racism. They are very like clear in their focus, and they're very focused on like preventing bodily harm to marginalized people in the community, and shutting down this kind of organizing. And you're right, like the political scene has shifted, and I would actually like to go a little bit beyond the scope of my work here and just like my experience, because to talk a little bit about my experience and probably yours as well, the thing that really disheartens me about Benjamin Hermansen was that like his murder did galvanize and mobilize, and it was the last such murder to galvanize and mobilize. In the 10 years between Benjamin Hermansen's murder and July 2011, there were several that straight up racist assassinations, and none of them had thousands of people walking in the streets in galvanizing and kind of like pledging to end right-wing racism the way Benjamin Hermansen did. And it even got to the point that when Anders Behring Breivik massacred all these people, putting it in a political context was a faux pas. Like presenting this as anything other than one lunatic was considered in very bad taste. So you had like two or three politicians that were thrown over the bus that were kind of the most like vulgar racists within the Progress Party. But even they have political careers now, right? There's the shift in Norway. We can kind of say that like the defeat against the political prong has worsened the situations that we will be fighting next in the street level prong here, because the window for what is acceptable has changed so drastically. And just, we are not shocked at the same things anymore. Like the murder of a black teenager, it will upset people, but it will not change entirely discourse and how and how we and like what people think the same way as Benjamin Monson's murdered will ever again, even to the extent where this horrific terror attack in 2011 was kind of like, we weren't allowed to put that in its proper political context. And it's a battle to do so now, 13 years later.
No, I mean, this is kind of the thing that struck me in reading that deeper historical context in your work, is then that in a way that the right-wing electoral strategy has been very successful, but also in a sense that the terrorism strategy has, in a, you know, perverse and fucked up way, been quite successful for them as well. And I'm, and I know, Alex, that some of your work is around this stuff, these shifts on the far right more generally. Like, where does this leave anti-fascism now? How are we, if we very successfully in the 90s managed to mobilize a broad-based and more narrow confrontational politics to defeat this part of the fascist movement, in a world where now far-right politics have become very mainstream in a way that I think would be difficult to imagine in the 90s, but also that the kind of threat of this so-called lone wolf terrorism, you know, it happened in Norway, it's happened in New Zealand, in the United States, and many other places. Like, how do we mobilize against, on the one hand, the fascists in suits, but also these more isolated individuals in the online cultures? And Alex, maybe you also have some thoughts on this as well. I know it's something you've thought about too, but where does anti-fascism go now, kind of?
Well, I think part of our trouble is trying to learn from past struggles without being kind of binded by them or tied down by them, and recognizing successes, but placing those successes within the context in which they happened. And I think sometimes as anti-fascists, we're in a bit of danger of thinking because things worked in the past or because certain things worked in other decades, that, you know, all we have to do is do the same thing. We need to create AFA all over again, or create, you know, whatever, you know, build up a big punk scene and or a skinhead scene or whatever it is, you know, like. And but having said that, I think there are some kind of real kind of things that we focus on which we're lacking, and I think maybe Adrian alluded to in the last answer, is that we don't really have it, at least in the UK, we don't have a mass movement, an anti-fascist mass movement, let alone a militant one. And I think orienting ourselves towards building that movement is really important. And that doesn't necessarily mean like getting a coalition of all the radical groups around and getting them oriented on this one trajectory. It's about building a kind of more fundamental level of trust between each other as comrades and between each other as kind of activists. Also, it involves understanding what the nature of the threat is and not being kind of bound to what we knew fashion to be even 10 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever, but like understanding how these groups interact with each other, where their kind of tensions are within their own movements as well, like exploiting those tensions and breaking them apart. And that's something I've actually said since we started this podcast. I may even have said it in the very first episode of the show. And, you know, part of what the work of the podcast is for us to understand anti-fascist history and what we can take from it, but also understand contemporary far-right movements and how we can break them apart as well. So, yeah, I don't have a solution to fascism, but there is a general, I have a general idea about where we need to go, for definite.
I agree with very much of what you just said. I think there are principles which we can learn from and follow, but the actual tactics and strategies will have to be different. I have like several thoughts of my own. One is I think it's dangerous at both a movement level and a government level to believe we can control a lot of these lone wolf things. Like these isolated kind of things. Like I don't like that the government thinks that they can just surveil or police us out of these. Terrorist attacks. And as a social movement, obviously we have no power to prevent one guy running people over in a van or similar kind of actions, right? So I think the focus for social movements have to be organizational and discursive. So we have to change discourse and we have to build power because those things we can do. And there's all kind of like I'm talking about a pre-internet. I'm talking about like so many things have changed, but also like leftist discourse has changed. Discourse generally has changed. It was very interesting, like, obviously it's not in the thesis, but, like, during this same period, we kind of went to, like, a triple oppression kind of analysis of within feminism to an intersectional analysis within feminism. So there's all kinds of discursive changes that have happened. Now I'm digressing, so I'll get back to what I was going to say. But like what I'm trying to say is things are different, just like Alex mentioned. I still think like a few things are true. Even though a lot is happening online, at some point, you have to take what has been festering online to the streets. And I think a very clear example of this was in the United States with the kind of... I forgot the guy who got punched in the face's name. I feel so lucky.
Richard Spencer.
Yeah. With the Spencers and the Miloses and all that kind of thing, is like they thought that their online activities translated to real power, right? And once they began trying to organize that power at a street level, traditional anti-fascist strategies were quite successful in running them back. But again, that's not to say that the general political climate in the United States improved, right? Not at all. Just like Vincent alluded to in Norway, right? So even like a success in fighting back Richard Spencer and like those kinds of organizations at Cal College campuses doesn't translate to a stronger or better position at a societal level. I actually think like one of the, and I'm saying this as kind of like, I've never been part of a political party. I've always been kind of very skeptical of electoralism. But I think like one of the most important things that are missing from electoralist spaces is a sense of that we shouldn't compromise. That this sense of these things are unacceptable and we will not take any part in normalizing them is, I think, a lot of what is missing from like general political discourse. And obviously it's been derided as no platforming or cancel culture or all these kind of like shortcuts to thinking as a way to dismiss them. But at like a discursive level, I think there needs to be, and this isn't just about anti-fascism, obviously. I think it's about leftist politics in general, where the militant anti-fascist left fighting racism to the electoral left, and the electoral left is too milquetoast and afraid and has no vision and has no project, really. And they don't fight for anything. And so we're kind of fighting with a hand tied behind our back here, where there is very little in terms of like vitality in the broader leftist project, where we can muster people to chase someone out of a place. That's possible to do. But in terms of like creating a new political reality, there has to be a project to create that new political reality. And I'm not sure where it's going to come from. In Norway, it's going to come from organization within minority communities, because they are by far the most vibrant and angry and interesting politically spaces.
Yeah, I think maybe in the UK, similarly, obviously there's been a big uptick in Palestine solidarity organizing, and before that, Black Lives Matter. But also, in London specifically, I would say campaigns around housing, right to life in a very expensive city, a very expensive country, is similarly somewhere where there is also a project there as well. I think maybe on that note, we'll leave things there.
Yeah. I think we've gone substantially longer than we usually do, but it's been a really good discussion. I think, Adrian, you've mentioned that. So this, your research, it's not currently, it's in Norwegian, I guess. So we can encourage our readers to finally do as they've always dreamed of doing and learn Norwegian. But do you have plans to?
It's so useful.
Do you have plans to publish it? Are there other resources that you want to draw people's attention to?
There is probably a lot of our readers have already heard about them, or your readers have already heard about them. I do have an aspiration, I would say, more than a plan, to adapt it into a more polemic book, in more of a debate format. And I would love for that to be in two languages. I'm a fluent English speaker, bilingual myself. So that is an aspiration, but it's not something your listeners need to look out for happening in the immediate future. I am a huge fan and am cited once in the Anti-Fascist Handbook book by Mark Bray, which was published quite a few years ago now, in I think 2016 or 17. It has a lot of my own kind of ways in that it, like Alex said, it looks backward, but not in a let's just repeat the history kind of way. It has a much more, these are some of the tools we can use kind of way, and these are some of the principles that that we should let inform us. And I'm a huge fan. So that's my recommended book for people to read. It's not particularly new, but I like it and think it's good.
Yeah, we had Mark on the show ages ago. I think maybe talking about the Anti-Fascist Handbook, actually. So, yeah, I also second that as well. Thank you both, and thank you, Selden, for leading on the discussion. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you for having me.
Goodbye. Thanks a lot.